It's Friday, January 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Jakarta mobilizes tight security following Thursday's attack. A former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations speaks about North Korea's nuclear program, and a lawsuit is filed involving a popular music hit featuring Justin Timberlake. It's all ahead. Indonesian security forces remain on high alert following the deadly attacks in Jakarta that killed at least two civilians along with five attackers. Indonesian investigators are now questioning at least three people in connection with the bombing and gun attacks. Indonesia's chief security minister says the suspected militants were arrested in Depok on the outskirts of the capital. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the bombings and subsequent gunfight with Indonesian forces in Jakarta that also wounded nearly two dozen people. I spoke with VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman, who's in Jakarta, and asked him about the increased security presence there.
I was in a upscale shopping mall to have a look around. The first thing I noticed is that the Starbucks chain had reopened. They had shut down after the Thursday attack because two of the blasts happened in front of one of their coffee shops. But I also saw police with automatic weapons patrolling in that shopping mall, definitely something out of the ordinary. And then when a motorcade of the vice president passed the attack site just a little while ago, we also noticed men with automatic weapons who got out and were looking around. And the Indonesians we spoke with, who were used to seeing these VIP motorcades, said that this was not normal at all. And the police chief has said that every police officer has now been mobilized to guard Jakarta.
Well, apparently a security team has been credited with saving lives because apparently a nearby shopping mall was one of the intended targets.
That's correct. And when you go into the five-star hotels and other places, it is routine, as it is in some other countries in Asia, to have security teams come up, ask to inspect your bags, use those mirrors on sticks to look under the cars, make sure there's no bombs in the undercarriage, that sort of thing. And they had their suspicions about this one particular vehicle. And from what we can make out, they were then directed to go down to another checkpoint, and that's where the bomb exploded. And they were obviously trying to get into this one shopping center, which is very well known and the oldest in the city.
Have any vigils taken place today?
Yes, there was one back at the site of the attack. They united under a banner. This was an ad hoc group that was quickly formed. And their banner read, "We are not afraid." They were also quite a bit defiant with some yelling, "Kill the terrorists," and that sort of thing. But for others there, it was a time for prayers. They left roses right in front of the Starbucks where there had been some casualties. I can't give you an exact number. It sort of grew as it went on for about an hour or so, but I can tell you that there was also a large crowd, perhaps an equal number of journalists, videographers, and reporters from all over the world who have converged on this site now.
Have authorities released details about the alleged perpetrators?
No, we don't have any names released. They have said that everyone, at least five of the jihadists who carried out this attack were Indonesians. There has been a sort of rivalry going on for the so-called the leadership of the Islamic State group in Southeast Asia. And there is, according to the analysts we've spoken with, a bit of a competition going on to see who should be the so-called emir if the Islamic State group in Syria were to declare Indonesia as one of its provinces. Of course, that sounds utterly ridiculous. This is the world's largest Muslim nation. It's a vibrant democracy, and nearly all of the Muslims who live here are quite moderate. And so that when Indonesians hear about something like that, it's almost ridiculous to them. But that's the way that these people think who are in these groups. And there have been hundreds of Indonesians who have shuttled, apparently, between Syria and Indonesia. And it's believed that some of them may have been involved in this attack, although, according to security analysts, they appeared to be poorly trained and, you know, they were trying to imitate what happened in Paris. But it was, fortunately, a very small number of casualties compared to the siege on Paris last November.
That's VOA Southeast Asia correspondent Steve Herman reporting from Jakarta. Now for reaction on social media, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akisholu.
Hi, Sarah. Yesterday, the hashtag Kami Tidak Takut, which in Indonesian means we are not afraid, became the top worldwide trend because people around the world started using it to express solidarity with Indonesian people and stand defiant against terrorism. Today, people are using that hashtag to share photos and videos of the vigil that people have started in Jakarta a day after the attacks. Our correspondent Steve Herman tweeted photos of a vigil at the Starbucks cafe where attackers holed up yesterday, and also people in the streets holding banners with the slogan, Kami Tidak Takut. But it's not just news media. Lots of people are also sharing photos of the vigils on Twitter and Instagram. And for the most part, that's what the conversation is right now.
Well, what else is trending on social media?
Last night, the GOP held its first debate of the new year, and people once again participated in debate watching and chimed in on social media by tagging their tweets with hashtag GOP debate. Twitter's government and elections team released data on Twitter's involvement during the debate. According to that data, the top tweeted moment of the night came when Chris Christie spoke directly to President Obama and said, "We are going to kick your rear end out of the White House coming this fall." That line also got a lot of applause from the audience during the debate. The most tweeted topics during the debate were foreign affairs, gun issues, and the economy, in that order. One really interesting piece of data is the follower growth during the Republican debate. According to Twitter, Donald Trump had the biggest increase in the number of followers, but right behind him was Bernie Sanders, who wasn't even on stage and is actually seeking a Democratic nomination. And in terms of the overall conversation on Twitter, Trump dominated with 38% of tweets about him, which is not usual. He's consistently been one of the biggest drivers of conversation on social media.
Thanks a lot, Olin. That's International Edition's Olin Akisholu. In other news, a former U.S. envoy says North Korea's latest nuclear test might be an attempt to seek attention from the United States. The purported test followed by an announcement that the communist country successfully tested a hydrogen bomb prompted many experts to wonder about the motivation behind Pyongyang's provocative move. Former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Bill Richardson, who extensively dealt with North Korean officials, told International Edition's G. Abby Lee that the new move might be aimed at garnering Washington's attention.
Some analysts say North Korea sent a message to the U.S. by conducting the fourth nuclear test. Now, do you share that view?
Yes, I do. I think the message to the U.S., hey, we're still around. I know you're all worried about the Middle East and Iran and Saudi Arabia, but we still are here in Northeast Asia. And the second message is we're not going to give up our nuclear proliferation. We're not going to give up developing nuclear weapons. This is our fourth, and you need to deal with us. Those are the messages.
Some experts say the Obama administration's approach to Pyongyang has not been so successful. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the policy of strategic patience of the Obama administration has made sense so far, but now it has to change. Sanctions, strategic patience have not moved North Korea to stop developing their nuclear weapons. In fact, they may have 10 now. They're continuing to be hostile. So what I think is a readjustment of our policy. I would get China more involved to pressure North Korea. I would find a way to bring in some special envoys, perhaps the Pope. We need some new approaches that involve the six-party countries.
Now, it seems pretty clear that achieving denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula has become much more difficult. Now, with that in mind, should the U.S. adjust its objective from complete denuclearization to non-proliferation?
Yes, I think we need to change our policy like we did with Iran. We said that Iran would not have any nuclear proliferation. They had to end their nuclear program. Now, they're heading in that direction, but it's not total.
North Korea see the nukes as a self-defense mechanism because they're seeing what happened in Afghanistan, what happened in Libya. Do you think North Korea has enough incentive to engage in a dialogue and give up their nuclear weapons?
I do believe they have an incentive. Here's a country that's economically falling apart. Their people are starving. They have sanctions. They can't have any kind of commercial growth whatsoever. There is no internet there. I think there's massive hunger. I think North Korea realistically has to find ways to improve their economic lot. And this is where I believe China can play an important role that has a lot of economic leverage on North Korea. But their big card is their nuclear development. And they're sending a message that that's their big card.
I see. Now, looking at the regional picture, do you think the continued provocations by Pyongyang has strengthened Washington's stance on urging Seoul and Tokyo to better cooperate?
Yes, I believe it's in our interest. Seoul, Tokyo, they're our allies, Japan, South Korea, we have treaty with them to come to our mutual defense. They're our trading partners. China is expanding its military influence, its commercial influence. Doesn't mean we have a Cold War conflict with China. We're strategic competitors with China. But I think it makes sense to have a balance in the region.
That's former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Bill Richardson speaking with VOA's G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Astronomers are watching a fascinating cosmic event some 3.8 billion light years from Earth. But they're not exactly sure what it is. It might be a supernova, a violent stellar explosion. If so, scientists say it has to be the most powerful supernova ever seen. They say the object at the center of this celestial wonder is pumping out the energy of hundreds of billions of suns, yet it's only about 16 kilometers across. Astronomers say the object called Assassin 15LH just might be a magnetar, or a very rare type of star. But even if it is a magnetar, they say it's so powerful that it's pushing the laws of physics. The scientists will look to the Hubble Space Telescope to finally solve this mystery later this year. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we hear about a lawsuit involving a hit by Justin Timberlake. After two embarrassing prison escapes of one of the most sought-after criminals in the world, Mexico's officials seem committed to extraditing Joaquin El Chapo Guzman to the United States. But Mexico won't be sending Guzman to the U.S. anytime soon. Under Mexican laws, an individual subject to extradition can contest that in the courts. And Guzman has already filed numerous injunctions to prevent his extradition that will stretch out the process. Michael Braun is a former chief of operations at the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, and he says it would be wise for Mexican authorities to speed up the process and send El Chapo to the U.S. to avoid another embarrassing escape. Braun says the U.S. has already formally requested Guzman's extradition and tells International Edition's Francis Alonso why the Mexican government should send Joaquin El Chapo Guzman to the United States.
I don't believe President Peña Nieto can afford another very embarrassing situation, another very embarrassing prison escape. When that happened last July, when Chapo escaped from Altiplano prison, Mexico's tier one supermax prison, if you will, when Chapo escaped, the president of Mexico's popularity plummeted, and it's been in the toilet ever since. I simply don't believe he can chance that happening again. The only way that he can prevent it from happening again is to extradite Chapo to the United States.
What crimes has Joaquin Guzman committed in the United States that the U.S. would want him here?
He's charged with conspiracy. He's charged with some other extraterritorial statutes, as I understand it. And it's important, Francis, to understand that I believe 9 different judicial districts in the United States, federal judicial districts, are holding indictments on Guzman. In the Eastern District of New York, he's also charged with federal capital offenses related to homicides that were very much part of his enterprise. He operates a global drug trafficking cartel that's responsible for at least half of the heroin that is plaguing our country today, as well as cocaine, methamphetamine, and marijuana.
Tell us your thoughts on Joaquin Guzman's interview with Sean Penn, and that he boasted having this huge arsenal and weaponry and boats and what have you at his disposal. What are your thoughts on that interview?
There's growing information and evidence that clearly shows that Guzman's trail had all but gone cold in October of last year when Mr. Penn decided to make his epic visit, and Mexico's intelligence and law enforcement assets and resources were able to pick up the trail, which ultimately led to Chapo's apprehension. So I'm
but
sure.
But you know, you've got to admit, though, it's a little embarrassing for, you know, law enforcement agencies, both in the United States and in Mexico, that, you know, an actor, Penn, would be able to use as contacts and reach this man seemingly out of nowhere and even get an interview with him. I mean, honestly, that's a journalistic coup in itself.
Well, you know, honestly, this meeting with Sean Penn, it's interesting because what Sean Penn basically, you know, accomplished was he interjected himself right in the middle of the most complex transnational organized crime conspiracy investigation our country's ever been involved in.
That is Michael Brown. He is former chief of operations at the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The Justin Timberlake and Jay-Z hit Suit and Tie made them millions of dollars and was used for a very popular Bud Light commercial. But as International Edition's David Byrd and VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee tell us, there's a group for the 1970s that is suing, claiming that part of the song was their hit Shownuff that was used without permission.
Justin Timberlake and Jay-Z's hit song Suit and Tie was a mega success. But now there's a group that's saying, hey, wait a minute, you didn't pay us to use a part of that. Shauna, what are we talking about here? This reminds me a lot of Blurred Lines with the Marvin Gaye family.
Well, in a way it does. So let me explain what happened. In 2013, on his Love Experience album, Justin Timberlake and Jay-Z released Suit and Tie. And so there apparently is a part of this song that had been sampled from a band called Sly, Slick, and Wicked. And they had a song back in 1973 called Shownuff. Now, we do know for a fact that that song was sampled. The question here is whether or not the proper rights or the complete rights were paid to the group. The group is saying that they were not paid for the vocal rights or the vocal performance that appeared in Suit and Tie. And on another part here, the Universal Music Group, who is actually being sued, apparently licensed the song for a very popular beer commercial here in the States. And so Sly, Slick, and Wicked, or these two members of the group, are saying they were never paid for that. And that's the biggest issue, because this was a huge campaign, and I'm sure that Universal Music Group and Bud Light and whoever else was involved in this got paid, and they think, well, it was a song that sampled our song, and therefore we should have a cut of this or enjoy a cut of this as well.
Now, this has been an issue since sampling started, though.
If a song has been used, and this is what makes it different from what went on with Blurred Lines, that was a question of whether or not the song inspired the other and to what degree. Here we know that there was a portion of the song that had been sampled. So if, in fact, that happens, I think as an artist, you are well within your rights to say, listen, if you use my music, you should pay for that. If you use part of my vocal performance, then you should pay for that as well.
What do you think? You can let us know. Send a tweet to Shauna. She is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also send one to at VOA underscore IE. And you can log on to our website. That's voanews.com. Let me show you a few things. Show you a few things about love. Hey.
And that's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the announcement of the Haitian presidential decree calling on the people of Haiti to participate in the second round of the presidential election and remaining legislative elections on January 24th. A Haitian commission created by President Michel Martelly on December 22nd was tasked with probing the country's disputed October 25th presidential election. While the commission's report noted that the first round vote was impacted by irregularities, it indicated that a final runoff could still take place. The report called for greater transparency, including a national dialogue, an analysis of the vote to determine the extent of the irregularities and fraud, and changes in the electoral process. A number of these recommendations were also noted by other international electoral observation missions during the course of the current electoral cycle. According to official results, government-backed candidate Jovenel Moïse received 32.76% of the vote after the first round of voting, and Jude Celestin, the former head of the State Construction Agency, garnered 25.29%. U.S. State Department spokesperson John Kirby said, "The U.S. looks forward to the completion of the electoral process and encourages all Haitians to participate peacefully and calmly in the vote. This is the opportunity for the Haitian people to have their voice heard regarding the future leader of their country. To that end, the U.S. urges everyone to ensure transparency and credibility in the fundamental democratic process." The United States and Haiti's other international partners urge state institutions and political actors to take all steps necessary to ensure a free and fair process that results in a peaceful transfer of power to a newly elected president by the constitutionally mandated date of February 7th. The United States reaffirms its commitment to working with the Provisional Electoral Council and Haiti's international partners in support of fair, credible, and secure elections that reflect the will of the Haitian people. The United States looks forward to working with the next democratically elected government on the many challenges facing Haiti and its people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.